Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Helen Crane. And coming up, the budget. What else? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, we got a big budget on Wednesday. £40 billion worth of tax hikes, businesses, landlords, investors, the wealthy, and even growth all hit hard. Interest rates are expected to stay high for longer, impacting mortgage holders. But on the plus side, we got one penny off a pint in the pub. So, Simon, Helen, welcome. Firstly, before we delve into the details, what do we make of the first female chancellor's first Labour budget? What was she trying to achieve? How did she come across? Helen, what did you make of it? First female chancellor.
Yeah, so the first Labour budget in 14 years, the first female chancellor, a lot of change in terms of what we've seen over the last 2 years, unsurprisingly. And I think an ideological change as well. So what's been said a lot over the last few weeks caused a lot of consternation is that this is a budget for working people. But what we saw was more taxes on people's wealth, people who have investments, pensions, to kind of make it so that they could, in their words, sort of help out lower income people, working people, whatever that is. So I think for a bit of an attack on the middle classes and on wealth, I think is really the message from this week.
Simon, you wrote a piece after Labour's first 100 days and called it, the first 100 days of miserabilism, I think you called it. Was this in the same tone or a bit more upbeat?
It was 100 days of miserabilism. It was an attempt at a play on the 100 days of solitude. I did think about 100 days of torpitude, but I think it was an attempt at being a lot more upbeat. And that was certainly what Rachel Rees was trying to do. I must admit that there was a point during the speech where I was sort of losing myself slightly in this flurry of and this. Once we started getting onto the kind of public spending stuff. But I think the problem was the damage was done before the budget. The damage was done, you know, from the end of July onwards, when this vacuum was created, the £22 billion black hole, the claimed £22 billion black hole, which, you know, Paul Johnson of the IFS says Rachel Reeves is over-egging, but she did get a hospital pass from the Conservatives in terms of the public finances. But that was combined with cutting the winter fuel allowance, but also bunging public sector workers an above inflation pay rise. And then it created this vacuum where we had months and months of speculation as to what taxes are going to rise. And there was no, whilst Labour could say, well, we didn't do that speculating, it wasn't shut down. And we've had people making rash financial moves in the meantime. But also, more to the point, the damage to sentiment has been done. Rachel Reeves could have delivered that budget 2 weeks into the Labour government. And it would have been better if she had delivered that budget 2 weeks into the Labour government. Because it could have been delivered on that note of optimism, of change, of we've got a new government. We want them to be more competent than the last lot. We need actually to put some more money into our public services because we're not putting enough money in. We've run them down to the ground. We need a more honest conversation on tax and everything like that. And I just think it's a huge wasted opportunity. And also, I'm largely disappointed because personally, I was very much hoping for a sort of move on, blank slate, you know, new government. Right. OK, what are we going to do here? How are we going to get growth going? And instead, it feels just a bit chaotic. A bit like we've had the usual tinkering around the edges, rather than having an honest conversation about some of these taxes and what we need to do with them. Unfortunately, Rachel Rees was completely hamstrung by the daft promise in the manifesto not to raise any of the main taxes, when ultimately what was referred to, again by Paul Johnson, the conspiracy of silence about the public finances. And it's instead ended up being a much more negative event than people needed it to be. And I think that if you are the man or woman in the street, there's a strong possibility that you're going to have come away from this budget thinking taxes have gone up. They've put taxes up when they said they wouldn't put taxes up. They've bunged a load more money at the public sector. There doesn't seem to be any plan. And you're hearing this thing about these things called gilt yields rising and mentioning words Liz Truss. And I think that's what people are going to come away with. When actually it could have been a really good opportunity to go, look, we need to have an honest conversation and change direction here.
I think they slightly over-egged the Tory hospital pass pudding, as it were. You didn't need to do it so much to sort of keep perpetuating that miserablism, as you called it. Everybody knew what a proverbial show it was. That's why they voted for you. And I found myself trawling through the internet, as one does, and landed on Tony Blair's first conference speech in Brighton. And don't get me wrong, this is not a praise of Tony Blair. This is about the tone. After 18 years not in government, say, today I want to set an ambitious course for this country to be nothing less than the model 21st century nation, a beacon to the world. We will never be the biggest. We may never again be the mightiest, but we can be the best place to live, the best place to bring up children, the best place to lead a fulfilled life, the best place to grow old. Wouldn't it be lovely, Helen, if we had got something of that? Because we are fed up. I think the country are fed up of being told, couple more years of hurt, couple more years of hurt, and this will get better when? Because we got the OBR forecast looking really rather bleak. It's not going to get better anytime soon, is it? Sorry for that rant.
That's okay. I agree. I think there was very little on entrepreneurship, innovation, growth. You know, they said it was all about growth, and actually very little was actually said about growth. You know, small businesses are actually really upset at some of the things that have happened in this budget. I understand that, you know, there is this big fiscal black hole. They can't, you know, be flinging sort of too much money around. But, you know, there are things that could be done to just give people a bit of positivity, a bit of, you know, let's sort of pick up the country and move it. For example, I was reading something earlier, AI was only mentioned once during the budget. And, you know, whatever you think about AI, it's a massive opportunity for businesses and something that we're kind of pretty good at in this country, mentioned once. It seems like she didn't really take the opportunities that were there for her to, you know, just inject a bit of confidence, really. And I think, you know, what Simon was saying, the average person in the street, you know, unless you are fortunate enough to have, say, a sort of big pension, lots of investments, you know, you won't have been necessarily badly hit by this budget. But also, there was no really sort of carrots given to you. You know, it wasn't necessarily too bad for someone on an average income, but I don't think they're going to look at it and think, oh, this is good, something good has happened to me from this. I think it's just a lot of negativity. You know, it wasn't bad for workers, but I don't think it was necessarily great for them. There's nothing that they'll be excited about. I mean, if I don't know how we'll get excited about the budget anyway, but yeah, it was very strange that there was no real no excitement, no sort of positivity.
Yeah, I mean, if the best that you can do, the sort of surprise rabbit out of the hat, is go, don't worry, we're not going to freeze the income tax threshold for another 2 years, but you've still got it for another four. I mean, that is like, wow. But Simon, as closely watched as the budget is, even as closely is obviously the OBR, and Rachel Reeves has really hammed up the OBR, you know, given them lots of plugging. Were they on her side? And the Institute Fiscal Studies, they're also worth a read. What have they said about the effect on the economy, and how have markets reacted?
Well, the OBR has revised its forecasts. We're going to see a bit more growth in the near term, but we're going to see less growth in the future. It suggests that it thinks we're going to see higher interest rates for a bit longer. Inflation is going to be around about target, but slightly above target. It's not going to be below target. And it, you know, noted that in terms of, for example, the national insurance contributions hike for employers. So rather than raise national insurance for employees, because that would affect working people, national insurance contributions for employers, that your employer has to pay for you, that's been raised because that doesn't affect working people. What the point is you don't see that in your pay packet. Therefore, the Chancellor thinks that can squeeze into the definition of doesn't affect working people and meets the manifesto promise. But the OBR has noted that that will result in lower wages. It expects 76% of that to be passed on in terms of lower wages. That will reduce the amount that would prospectively be raised from employer NI and will drag back the supposed 25 billion, which also, because you have to take into account that public sector employers are going to have to be reimbursed for this, otherwise there's going to be an even bigger hole in the public sector employers' budget, which effectively would be a cut to public spending, that's going to be pulled back. The IFS, fairly damning, to be honest, not the kind of verdict you would want on a you know, new budget, new government. Paul Johnson referred to them as playing silly games. That was in reference to this front loading of public spending and then pretending that public spending is going to be able to fall. Day to day public spending is going to be able to fall, you know, in the latter part of the forecast period. Not putting up fuel duty, which fuel duty has been frozen now for a very, very, very long time. 5p was cut off it as a sort of, you know, emergency measure. Arguably, if we are shifting towards this, you know, electric car future that supposedly we're meant to be and net zero and so on, maybe we should be putting up fuel duty. It'd be very, very unpopular, but maybe we should be putting up fuel duty, you know, because actually when it comes down to it, it's like, okay, are we going to put up national insurance on your pay or are we going to put up fuel duty? Which one should we do, kind of thing? Maybe we should be putting up fuel duty there. And reflecting actually what I said, Paul Johnson's verdict on it, he said, the budget did signal a change of policy direction, but if the government is really wanting change, then it's not just the levels of tax and spending it needs to look at, it's how it prepares a coherent strategy, how it presents what it is doing, and how it builds confidence through transparent communication. Mm-hmm. And again, criticised allowing these rumours to swirl mm-hmm. for so long. And I would say that on that note, I think what we're missing here is creating a framework for the public finances, which includes tax, that is aspirational. Our tax system is not aspirational. I don't hold Rachel Rees responsible for this. A lot of that has to go on to the previous government and the way that stuff has been tinkered around the edges and problems with the tax system have been allowed to emerge and then stay there. Not to bang the same drum again, but for example, the removal of the personal allowance that creates this 60% tax rate that we have been sitting on for so long now. And the level at which that's taken away hasn't gone up. If it had, it would be happening at £100,000-£150,000. Instead, it's still happening at £100,000. And there is a cottage industry in people earning between £100,000 and £125,000 in this country, avoiding doing more work or being paid more. Mm. That is totally nuts. These are some of the most productive people in the economy. And instead of them wanting to take on more work and wanting to earn more money, an entire cottage industry has grown up in them avoiding taking on more work. We have the highest tax burden. You know, we are forecast to have the highest tax burden ever, actually. But if you look at the numbers, what has happened is more and more of that has been shifted onto higher earners and less onto middle earners. Now, you could argue that that is right and it is progressive. But if we want the public services that we say we want and that Labour say they're going to deliver to us, the cold hard reality of it is that we do probably need to be taxing the middle earner more money. It's very difficult to achieve what is trying to be achieved whilst only pushing that burden onto higher earners, because what's interestingly happened is that middle earners have seen a big tax cut through the Tory years and higher earners have seen a big tax rise, and that, you know, continues. Again, the thing with pensions, the things with inheritance tax that we're going to talk about, I just mm-hmm. think it's not creating that aspirational element that we need in order to get that growth.
But taxes at record highs, not ruled out further taxes to come down the line. The IFS says another, 9 million is needed. Simon, are we going to get more?
Oh, there's always more tax rises you can have.
Where's it going to come?
Always more tax rises you can have. What do you do now about capital gains tax? We'll talk about this in a minute, but I've been put up a little bit. Is there the kind of, oh, well, they'll put up a little bit more, they'll put up a little bit more. What do you do about inheritance tax, where you kind of fail to tackle the actual problem, which is the whole thing needs a total overhaul? What do you do about things like the frozen thresholds, where, oh, we're not going to continue it, but what if they suddenly change their mind and continue it? And all these other things. I think that's where you need that coherent strategy, that sort of like, right, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, and these are our ambitions. The gamble is, okay, that this is enough and we get the growth that we need, we improve productivity, and therefore we don't need the tax rises in the future. That's what's going on here. There's a speculate to accumulate. I just don't necessarily think we're speculating enough to accumulate enough. We might still be stuck in that hamster wheel that you're talking about.
All right, well, let's dig into some of those details, shall we? One of the things that they could have done, having blamed the Tories so much and saying they left them in a parlous state, which I'm not denying, by the way, I'm just saying that's the case, was reverse the unaffordable national insurance cut. But they decided not to do that. Instead, the biggest tax rise will come in the form of, as you've both mentioned, increased national insurance contributions for employers, up 1.2% to 15%. The threshold at which it is charged has also been slashed from £9,100 to £5,000 a year. All but the smallest of businesses will have to pay up, with concerns that it could backfire on the government by delivering less money than planned, reduce wage growth, slow business hiring, and ultimately push up prices for consumers. Now, Labour said, as Helen pointed out, they didn't want to tax working people, and according to their manifesto, but this doesn't count, right, Helen? This isn't a tax on working people. This is a tax on businesses, who are not that happy about this, by the way.
I think it does count, I'm afraid. It's essentially what they've done is, instead of taxing your money once it's in your hands or just before it's in your hands, they're taxing it before it even gets to you, which means that essentially employers, they're going to pass all of this on to their employees. Of course they are. If they're having to pay more, then they're going to, you know, they are going to pay their workers less. They're going to contribute less into their pensions. Of course, you know, of course companies, if they're being taxed more, that's going to affect how much they pay their workers and how much they contribute. You know, businesses have to make money. They're not just going to swallow it, especially small businesses. You know, who work on these kind of fine margins. A lot of them have already come out and said, you know, we're going to have to reduce the amount of people we hire. We're going to have to cut hours. We might have to cut our wages. So,
and of course, minimum wage going up as well. That's going to put extra pressure.
Exactly. And, you know, it's difficult to, you know, it's difficult to say you shouldn't put the minimum wage up. You know, people on the minimum wage kind of deserve as much as they can get. But again, it sounds good, but then the businesses that are having to cope with this, you know, what's that going to be? It might mean that someone who they might have hired now isn't going to have a job at all. So it's a tricky one. I think the pension sort of element of it is particularly dangerous. You know, we're already seeing people contributing less to their pension, you know, cost of living. And now if employers are going to cut their contributions to people's pensions, it's just pushing this problem of people not having enough money when they hit retirement down the road even further. We're already going to have a big problem when people who are working now retire. You know, things like automatic contributions have really helped, you know, encourage people to start saving. But if things like this start happening, it's kind of bringing that problem up again, you know, of people just getting to retirement and not having enough to live on.
To be clear, this is about national insurance contributions on employees' wages. It's not on their pensions, which had been speculated. It's just the idea that if companies are going to cut costs, they're going to look where they can reduce those benefits for people. However, there is a bit of a sort of quirk in the system. We did speculate that perhaps salary sacrifice might be hit. It wasn't. And there is a way that you can sort of reduce your national insurance contributions by salary sacrificing into your pensions. Isn't that right, Simon?
There is. This does, however, presume that people have unlimited amounts of money that they can just salary sacrifice into their pension.
Quite.
And this crops up with things like the removal of child benefit or the removal of the personal allowance. And it's like, oh, well, you could get your net adjusted income down by just salary sacrificing some more into your pension. I'd love to meet some of these people with all this spare money to just salary sacrifice into their pensions each year and possibly say to them, I tell you what, why don't you spend some of the money, get that growth going in the economy? Because if we had all of these people who could just do that anyway, I don't think we'd be in the problem that we're in. I think, unfortunately, after, you know, if you look at inflation over the last, you know, since that income tax freeze, threshold freeze, inflation has been like 25%. That's quite a big rise in the cost of living. And then to sort of say, oh, well, you could just salary sacrifice some more in. But you can do. You could put some more money into your pension, salary sacrifice it, which reduces your wages. And that helps out employers because it means that your employer also reduces their wage bill and they save on their national insurance. But I think the problem with the national insurance thing is that actually, in terms of the actual amount, it's not that much per employee. It's the aggregate element.
Yeah. And for really small businesses, Simon, it does really hit hard, though, doesn't it? I've seen a lot of really unhappy, nervous businesses on like social media, really concerned about this.
If you look at businesses for whom a lot of their costs are wages, then this is a problem, particularly those who might be in sectors that are struggling slightly at the moment anyway. For example, let's take hospitality, where a lot of people are on minimum wages. So the wages are going up, the national insurance contributions are going up, and then the really important thing is that the level at which they kick in has come down from 9,000 to 5,000. And there is this employment allowance element, but that only covers really the smallest businesses that employ relatively few numbers of people, and businesses that employ larger numbers of people are going to take a hit on this. And it's very difficult to argue that it's a pro-growth policy. It's going to crimp people's pay rises. And actually, going back to that coherent strategy, what we really need after a decade of very, very low real wage increases is actually to get back to a scenario where people's wages go up by more than inflation. We have actually, funnily enough, after the inflation spike, managed to get ourselves back into that position. This creates a scenario where we're less likely to continue in it.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Dan Breecroft of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Dan, here's a question on what this week's budget has meant for the markets. What's happened to the FTSE since the budget, and who are the risers and fallers?
So, since the budget announcement on Wednesday, the FTSE 100 has fallen. Initially, the index fell by about 0.8% as investors were assessing the implications of the budget. Some Labour changes have created a nervousness about the prospects for the UK economy, and this has led to the FTSE 100 falling to the lowest level since August. In terms of the fallers, house builders have struggled, and this is due to concerns about interest rates staying higher and for longer. So Taylor Wimpey, Persimmon and Barrett Redrow have all fallen around 6%. It's been a similar story for retailers, so companies such as Kingfisher and Next fell around 4%. The oil and gas sector did not fare as poorly as some might have expected. So Shell, BP, they were largely flat. On the flip side, some areas did do well. So prior to the announcement, gambling companies had priced in a Labour tax raid, but this didn't happen. So they managed to stay out of Rachel Reeves' firing line and the share prices jumped. Entain was the biggest winner on the day, up 9%. On the whole, markets were down. However, it's worth saying that things picked up on Friday morning, up 0.6%, and all things considered, the reaction could have been a lot worse.
I understand gilt yields are something that people have been talking about a lot this week, and they've actually moved in the opposite direction since the budget. Why are they rising, and what does that tell us about interest rates and the economy?
Gilt yields rise and fall based on a few factors. So investor expectation around inflation and interest rates, the level of new gilts being issued, and the yield available elsewhere, so US Treasuries, for instance. Since the autumn budget, we know that the government is going to increase their borrowing over the next 5 years, and they're going to release more gilts to the market. This supply of gilts will obviously more debt, and investors will demand higher returns for that. With this, there's the expectation that we're going to see higher interest rates and for longer, and gilt yields move inversely to gilt prices. So when a gilt prices fall, gilt yields will rise. And as the market expects higher interest rates, in order to remain competitive, gilt prices have to fall for the gilt yield to rise. So in a nutshell, rising gilt yields are going to indicate higher inflation, increased government borrowing, potentially higher interest rates. For the economy, that's going to impact growth. And it somewhat explains the nervousness that we've had in the last 48 hours.
Dan, thank you very much.
Thanks, Helen.
Welcome back. There was much speculation ahead of the budget about changes that could happen to pensions. Now, neither a reduction in the tax-free lump sum amount nor the introduction of a flat rate of tax relief came to pass. What did, though, was the announcement that pensions will now form part of your estate when you die for inheritance tax purposes, dragging far more people into the inheritance tax paying net. So, firstly, Helen, I was asked what was the best general news, I suppose, for everybody for this budget. All I could think was that they didn't tinker with pension savings, which I think would have been, had such a detrimental impact on people's confidence in pensions when we're already not paying enough for our future anyway.
Yes, it is good news that they didn't tinker with the amount that you can take out tax-free from your pension. People will be really pleased about that, apart from people who were so worried that that was going to happen that they preemptively took out lump sums from their pension before the announcement. You know, that obviously wasn't advised. Experts said, you know, you really need to think carefully about doing this. But some people, you know, there was a lot of speculation about this, and some people were so frightened they did it anyway. And those people are now sitting there with, you know, tax lump sums sitting in their bank account or their savings. I think, God, what do I do with this now? As it just shows the danger of these things being sort of floated and then not happening. But, you know, that this isn't a Labour or this budget thing. This is a thing that's been happening for years. But I think, yeah, in general, that is good news for pension savers.
What did you make of the Chancellor's decision to include pensions into the inheritance tax? I mean, low-hanging fruit on the guess on this one. It's sort of been ripe for a while. But what do you think, Helen?
It is. And I suppose on the face of it, it's perhaps difficult to feel sorry for people who are going to have so much unspent from their pension pot when they die that, you know, it will be dragged into the sort of inheritance tax net. However, you know, there are people who've really diligently saved into private pensions for many, many years. And, you know, should they be punished? It's a tricky one, isn't it? One thing it is going to do is bring a lot more people into inheritance tax. So the threshold for that has stayed the same. There was some speculation that they would bring it down. So 325,000 is the amount that you can pass on to descendants tax-free. That increases to 500,000 if you pass on your home to your direct descendants, and if you're a couple, you can potentially pass on up to 1 million. So that's a large amount. However, if you're someone who does have a big pension, they don't think they're going to be able to spend in their lifetime, you know, that could easily push you over the limit into paying inheritance tax. So it's definitely something that people are going to be thinking about, especially because at the moment, a lot of people kind of stash money into, well, a lot of people who are lucky enough to be able to afford to, will stash money into their pension because they know that if they pass that on, that is a way to get around inheritance tax. And that's precisely what Rachel Reeves was trying to stop people doing by doing this. You know, she said she was removing the opportunity for individuals to use pensions as a vehicle for inheritance tax planning by bringing unspent pots into the scope of inheritance tax. So that's the plan. It is something people need to worry about. It's expected to affect around 8% of estates each year and raise 640 million in 2027-28 when it comes in. So bigger.
640 million doesn't seem a lot, does it?
I mean, in the scope of government spending, I guess that, but it's going to go up. So by the third year it's in, that's going to be 1.46 billion. So it's the kind of thing that will presumably just kind of go up more and more as the, yeah, as the policy's in place.
And the threshold stays the same. I mean, it's fair, though, isn't it, Simon, that people had been using pensions as an inheritance tax vehicle, and that's not really what it's for. It's there to provide you with safety and financial security in retirement. However, doesn't it make it incredibly difficult to plan? Because you could, and let's hope you live a long, long, long life, but you may not. And then that could just throw all of your inheritance tax planning, I suppose, out of the water. And then we have the issue of double taxation. Will that stay? What do you think, Simon?
I'll throw a spanner in the works here and say that I think this pension inheritance tax planning thing is a bit of a red herring, right? Because firstly, the way that the rules worked were they were outside of your estate for inheritance tax, for a start. But they were only tax-free for your beneficiaries if you died before the age of 75. Now, in my mind, if you were unlucky enough to have your relative, your parent, for example, because it doesn't matter between spouses, because stuff moves free between spouses of inheritance tax anyway. If you were unlucky enough to have your parent die before the age of 75, that's early, okay, then do you know what? You get a bit of beneficial tax treatment, absolutely fine with me. After the age of 75, withdrawals were taxed at your income tax rate. That would be 20%, 40%, or 45%. But seeing as that would be added to the income of the person taking the money out, it doesn't make them a great inheritance tax vehicle, avoiding vehicle, sorry, because you'd need to stay below the 40% tax threshold at £50,000 in order to be getting a lower tax rate than inheritance tax. And in fact, actually, if somebody did pass on a big pension and then their beneficiaries wanted to take the money out, it's highly likely they'd end up paying a higher tax rate than inheritance tax. They could end up paying 45%. So I think that whilst this has been very widely talked about, I do think it was a bit of a red herring in the system. And I think, again, we move on to this unintended consequences thing. Now, if you look at the Pension and Lifetime Savings Association's suggestion for the amount of money that you need for a comfortable retirement, and who doesn't aspire to a comfortable retirement? I aspire to a comfortable retirement, okay? We were talking aspiration earlier. I'm going to put it on the line and say, I would like to have a comfortable retirement. At the moment, the PLSA says that would cost you £43,100 a year. Okay, if you knock off your state pension from that, so take off, you know, the £11,500 or whatever the state pension is, that's about £31,600 you're going to need every year. The pension pot that you would need to deliver that is £790,000. So people need to save themselves £790,000 in their pension just to have a comfortable retirement. Mm-hmm. Okay, they're building up that defined contribution pension. Well, now that that forms part of their estate for inheritance tax, add their house to it, going to be a lot more people paying inheritance tax, isn't there?
Yeah.
40% on that. And we think about inheritance tax, always a problem for older people. And generally it is. You know, people tend to die older, pass it on. People think about that they'll get inheritances in their kind of 30s. They're not. Most people get inheritances in their kind of 50s, like after their kids have left home. Mm-hmm. But you take the unfortunate situation where somebody with some kids dies in their 40s or their 50s, leaving behind perhaps, you know, two teenage children. Well, you know, in fact, actually, the really unfortunate situation where both parents die, right? Okay. The 40s, 50s leave two, you know, children orphaned. Add their pension pots to their house. Those poor children are going to end up losing 40% of a big chunk of money. Is that right? I don't necessarily think it is. And I think it does create this scenario where all of a sudden it massively swells people's estates. And we're not meant to be thinking of pensions as inheritance tax vehicles, but maybe we shouldn't be thinking of pensions as something inheritance tax should be charged on in the first place anyway. I think we've just created even more of a muddle and scenarios where you can find that even more unfair elements in place. It's going to increase the number of people losing some of the residents' nil rate band because they'll go over the 2 million that it takes it. And as you said, there's this threat of double taxation that's been raised. If they're now part of the inheritance tax net, are we keeping the old system where it was, you know, there was no income tax charged before the age of 75, but income tax charged after the age of 75. And if so, we're keeping that and we're charging inheritance tax on them, you potentially end up with a 67% rate of tax on those inherited pensions. And I think that the problem here is that what we really needed to do was overhaul inheritance tax completely. We've got a perfectly good report that was compiled by the Office of Tax Simplification 5 years ago that said that this tax was, you know, to use that horrible phrase, not fit for purpose anymore and needed a total overhaul. And instead of overhauling it, we've done a bit of tinkering around the edges. We've kept the allowances frozen. So there's a huge amount of fiscal drag going on there. And so it's broadly been seen as a relatively sensible move, but I just think it's going to be another one that creates more unintended consequences. And what we should have done is sorted out the tax altogether.
I mean, the good thing is it won't come in until April 2027. So there's never a good time to die.
Again, yeah, we talked about this in the moves
it's not ideal, is
before
it?
The budget. And I did suggest at that time that dying to avoid tax was a bad move. And I'm going to put my neck on the line and I'm going to suggest try to avoid dying early in order to avoid tax.
Yeah, there are better ways to deal with it. I do want to ask about annuities or final salary pensions. Are they affected?
Your defined benefit pension, final salary or career average, which most people get nowadays, and your annuity dies with you. So you don't have that inherited problem. And actually, this is because this is a knock-on of pension freedom, actually, this thing where most people now keep their pension pots invested. So yes, those look even more attractive. I mean, a defined benefit pension just looks really attractive anyway. If someone offers you a defined benefit pension, take it. An annuity, we're already seeing more people buy annuities because annuity rates have gone up. They're not as terrible as they were. And if you want to know more about that, go back a couple of podcasts and listen to our Steve Webb special where he went into a lot more detail on it. But yeah, maybe more people will buy an annuity with some of their pension now. I don't think we're going to go back to the scenario where people use their whole pension pot to buy an annuity, but maybe using an annuity to buy some of it and getting that guaranteed income will look a bit more attractive.
Sticking with inheritance tax, and there was no change to gifting, as had been speculated, nor the 7-year rule, which some thought may have been extended to 10 years. That didn't happen, but we did get some changes that really got Jeremy Clarkson's back up.
The Chancellor has decided to row back some of the advantages that are on offer for agricultural land and also for passing on businesses. And this is because these two elements were in place to try and help farming families and also family-owned businesses, and to avoid the scenario where the farm or parts of the farm had to be sold off due to pay an inheritance tax bill, or businesses had to be split up, or some of the business had to be sold off to pay an inheritance tax bill. Over the years, this has been increasingly taken advantage of by wealthy people, particularly the agricultural one. The agricultural one is a big one for the very wealthy who buy up land. They pay someone to farm it for them so they can say that it's farmed. They can then pass it on inheritance tax-free. Business assets shifted into this buying AIM shares, which basically qualify for this relief. It's not really that much owning businesses and passing them on that's going on. It's buying shares in other businesses. The idea that these two things would be removed completely have caused serious headaches for farming families. And also for the AIM market, which has had a bit of a slow motion car crash of prices. The Chancellor has decided not to remove them completely, but to limit the benefit of them. So effectively, you're going to get a kind of 50% off the inheritance tax scenario, and also to cap the amount for the family farms. This has been very unpopular amongst farmers who are caught between a rock and a hard place here, because farmers are finding it very difficult to buy land because land prices have been forced up by wealthy people buying land for the inheritance tax benefits. Now farmers are being squeezed as a result of those wealthy people buying up farmland to use for inheritance tax benefits and having a cap put on the inheritance tax benefit that they can get. I don't know what you do about this issue. I think there was probably a better way of dealing with it. And it's the kind of thing that needed to be, again, not to hammer home the point too much, but looked at properly in the context of how do we overhaul the inheritance tax system. I know I have relatives who farm. I have relatives who live in farming country, and I know how much of an issue this is with the wealthy people buying up the farmland stuff. And that it is causing that bit in itself is causing farmers a headache. And then you've also got this scenario where in other parts of the country, you know, around the kind of southeast and the commuter belt, the price of farmland has been driven up massively by developers optioning the land because they think they're going to get to build houses on it. And at the stroke of a planner's pen, the land goes from being worth tens of thousands of pounds to maybe a couple of million. Lottery style money, right? Lottery winning style money, because somebody says you can build some houses on that field, whereas previously you could only grow some crops or graze some animals. And the whole system is a colossal mess. And the people it is impacting, Jeremy Clarkson is right, is farmers who, if you have watched Clarkson's Farm, which is pretty good, even if you don't like Jeremy Clarkson. I quite like Jeremy Clarkson, but even people who don't like Jeremy Clarkson and watch it say it's really good. And in fact, my father-in-law, who isn't necessarily a huge Jeremy Clarkson fan anymore and used to be a farmer, says it's really, really good. So it gets the verdict from him. Clarkson is right. The people this is harming is farmers who've already been harmed in the past and are already really, really struggling to make a living, despite on paper theoretically looking like they're rich.
All right, there was speculation that capital gains could be introduced on death. We didn't get that. We did get a rise in CGT, though. Not for those with second homes, but landlords, Helen, must have felt that the budget gave with one hand in that way, but took with the other. The other sort of surprise, I suppose, or one of the few surprises that hadn't been mooted before, was this rise to the stamp duty surplus. Firstly, capital gains tax rise. Tell me about it. How much? Who will it impact?
This is a move that mostly affects small investors, so people who invest in stocks and shares. What Rachel Reeves has essentially done is to bring capital gains on stocks and shares and also some personal possessions in line with what people pay on second homes. So for higher rate taxpayers, that has gone from 20% to 24%, and for basic rate taxpayers, it's gone from 10% to 18%. So that's a significant jump. Capital gains tax, obviously the tax paid when you sell investments, property, possessions, and you make a profit. So not all good news for landlords and second homeowners, though. Quite bad news. So when it's on the buying side, it's when they're buying property rather than when they're selling property. They obviously pay stamp duty. At the moment, well, as of 2 or 3 days ago, they used to pay a 3% surcharge. So on top of what someone buying a home to live in would pay, they pay an extra 3% stamp duty. They're now paying an extra 5%. So really ratcheting up the tax that they pay on purchases. Again, landlords, you know, a group that a lot of people don't necessarily have much sympathy for. Same goes to with second homeowners. However, there is a chance that this could end up affecting renters. I mean, this could be tens of thousands of pounds more for landlords buying a sort of average price property. So, you know, they're probably going to charge higher rents on that property because they've just had this extra sort of bill whacked up on them. They might decide not to buy any new properties at all, which also causes a problem for tenants because, you know, we don't have enough homes in the UK anyway. If there are even fewer homes available to rent because landlords aren't buying them, then that causes a problem. You know, fewer homes, more competition, again, higher rents. And I think there is sort of a bit of an irony in this coming from the Labour budget, in that, you know, part of the reason we need landlords to buy so many more properties is because the government builds nowhere near enough council homes anymore. So it's kind of a full circle. You know, maybe we wouldn't need landlords as much if the government was still sort of building homes, or at least funding sort of more homes to be built for people who who need to rent. But there you go, that's what they've gone with.
Yeah. Also, Helen, stamp duty rates returning to what they were, basically.
Yes, exactly. So this is something that affects all home buyers, first time buyers as well. Back in 2022, I think it was Rishi Sunak temporarily cut the rates of stamp duty that people pay when they buy. They're due to go back up 2025 March to the rates that they were before that. The Rectories could have chosen to keep them at the lower level, which she hasn't. So that means that buyers are faced with this sort of deadline. You know, if they can buy before March, then they're going to save on stamp duty, perhaps not pay stamp duty at all if they're a first-time buyer. So if you are looking to move, it would be quite a good idea to get in there before March.
Quite. Also, Simon, other changes that were not in the speech but were in the budget document. I can't say it's a recommended read, but if you're struggling to sleep at night, it's 170 pages that you could work your way through should you so choose. But we'll break it down for you. Bye-bye UK ISA is the first one, Simon.
Ah, the British ISA. We barely knew you. Yes, the idea of creating a whole new ISA for people to invest an extra £5,000, but it had to be into UK stocks, which then triggered the kind of discussion that could only be bettered by the one later on about exactly what counts as working people. As to what were UK stocks, was an investment trust one, was a UK company that did most of its business overseas one, and so on and so on, has been knocked on the head. There's lots of people actually who put forward an argument that says that if we're going to give people a tax break for investing, we should encourage them to invest more in the UK. That does create home bias, which is potentially an issue. Really what you should be doing is buying a tracker fund that invests around the world. But then you're sticking 60% of your money into the US, and let's face it, the US stock market doesn't need any more support than all of the support it gets from global investors right now. But the British ISA is no more and we will not have it. Probably didn't need to invent a whole new ISA and complicate the system further. So I'll give that one a tick.
No other changes to ISAs, though. Lee can stop having sleepless nights. That's good news for Lee. Helen, child benefit, though.
Yes, it's something else that was buried a bit in the document. And I think people maybe haven't quite realised that this has happened. So the previous government had a plan to fix this sort of inequity in the system, which sort of penalised particularly single parents and sort of higher earning single parents. So this is something called the higher income child benefit charge, which means that if you earn above a certain amount, then you start to lose some of your child benefit. And the way the rules worked were that the income would be taken based on the highest earner's income alone. And the limit was £60,000. That's where the benefit starts to taper. So we have this strange situation where if your household had two parents who both earned £59,000, you would receive full child benefit. Whereas if you were a single parent and you earned £60,000, you would see some or all of it taken away. The Conservatives had a plan to change that, to sort of fix that inequity, but Labour has sort of rowed back on that. So that unfortunately still remains. Again, it's one of those policies, you know, people earning £60,000, people don't necessarily have a lot of sympathy. But if you are a single parent, you know, as a household income, that's not necessarily, you know, you're not a rich household necessarily, you know, depending on how many kids you have or where you live in the country. So I think it's it seemed a sort of easy and a fair fix. But obviously the situation is that by not doing that, then the government will continue to sort of make more money back in taxes. I suppose perhaps an obvious one for Labour.
Simon, a fuel duty frozen, as you mentioned, but a stealth tax on new petrol and diesel motors. What's this?
I should say, actually, that it has to be noted that when the Tories said they were going to remove this inequity in the system in their manifesto, that was them belatedly waking up after 14 years in government to the inequity in the system that they had created themselves with their own policy. Because until George Osborne created the policy of taking child benefit off people, this was not an issue. And again, one of the reasons why I think it is an issue is because it creates another cottage industry and people avoiding being paid more money in order to put themselves below a threshold. The other thing that the budget didn't tackle is this insane cliff edge for childcare. For younger children, which in theory we're doing this because it's good for children and good for getting adults working in the economy, giving them some free childcare. But we're also taking it off those people who are earning more than £100,000 completely. And it creates this colossal cliff edge that again leads to people trying to avoid being paid more money or doing more work, which is completely stupid. To go on to the fuel duty, which is the thing that you asked me about, though. What is this stealth tax that you ask about? Well, it's also known as the showroom tax, and it is the tax that people pay on the first year rates for new cars registered after the 1st of April 2025, and that is going to go up. So basically, to try to force drivers to choose greener vehicles, it's not only is going to push up the cost of owning a car in those first years. Buyers face first year road tax costs of between 270 and a staggering £5,490 a year. Now, it should be said that is only on the most polluting vehicles. But if you were to take a middle of the range petrol or diesel vehicle, you'd be paying £1,400 a year for in first year road tax, which is a lot of money. And it's also not been widely welcomed by the car industry, which is trying to sell people cars.
Unsurprising. Okay, right. Well, that wraps up. There's plenty more in it. Like I said, 170 pages worth. Fill your boots. As I said at the start, the Chancellor didn't rule out further tax rises in years to come. I keep getting alerts on my phone saying about gilt markets, as you keep talking about, Simon, yields going up, markets absorbing the news, etc., etc. Not quite Liz Truss-esque, but or quasi-quatting-esque, but how is it going down with the markets? How is it likely to play out? How will this impact things like interest rates, inflation, our mortgages? What else is down the line?
Yes, gilt yields have risen. Gilt yields have been on the rise anyway. Again, I would say this is a kind of major bet scenario where really there was no concerns over the new government when the new government was elected. In fact, it was broadly welcomed by the markets. And it's largely a result of the 100-odd days of miserabilism that we've ended up in a scenario where markets have started to question the economic moves of the Labour government. They're going to borrow more money. That means that we're going to have to raise more money from investors. That means that investors are thinking, well, hang on a minute, we might have to charge a bit more money in order to lend this money to you. 10-year gilt yields rose 7 basis points to a 12-month high of 4.48% on Friday morning. To put the Liz Truss thing into context, we're looking for about 4.6% to match that. We're not in a Liz Truss moment. This is not the same thing. And actually, there's other things that are moving up gilt yields anyway, interest rate expectations, all that kind of stuff that doesn't necessarily only have to do with the budget. I think broadly speaking, actually, what you'll find is that markets settle down. We now have certainty. We've had the budget. We know what's going to happen.
Better the devil you know.
The devil you know. And things will move on. I would say in a month or two's time, everything should be fine. However, there is another major event to come.
Yes, quite.
There may be something of a talking point. And that is the US election. In an unbelievably febrile atmosphere after what happened last time round. Who knows, not necessarily what the election result is going to be, but who knows what the reaction to the election result is going to be in America. Hopefully everything is absolutely fine. But I tell you what, you look at America and you think that nice orderly transference of power with just a bit of grumpiness about people pointing fingers about £22 billion black holes in the UK. We are lucky to live in the country that we live in, not a country where you've got that scenario going on. And let's hope that they learn a very big lesson from last time and everything is absolutely fine, whoever wins that election.
Yeah, let's hope so, Simon? Let's hope so. I'm sure we'll be talking about that in the coming weeks. Right, that wraps up our budget roundup. I want to end with Simon's stat of the week, even though we've thrown a lot of stats at you. Simon, do you have just one more?
Right, here you go. Stat of the week, and we're going to end on a positive note because do you know what? It's always great if you hold premium bonds to get that notification that says you have won some money. The odds of winning a premium bond prize from December onwards, 22,000 to one. Okay, the premium bonds price fund rate will be 4.15% at that point. Mm. But do you know what? It's long odds, but when you do win that prize, it does make you feel happy.
Right. That's good news, is it then? 22,000.
Well, it's not great news because actually odds are currently 21,000 to one. But what's 1,000 to one between friends?
I mean,
statistically significant, I think probably people who know about maths would tell you, but
I would,
you know,
say. All right, then.
If you were going to worry about that kind of stuff, you'd put your money in a cash ISA that paid a guaranteed rate higher than the premium bonds prize rate anyway.
All right, then. That is it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team, anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.